Yeah, I was trying to write my question. It's not clear. But yeah, I'm really interested in this notion of seed of dream that you have just mentioned at the end. And I would like to know if it means that as dreams, these moments of pure sensation or body sensation as childbirth is or could be, does it mean that as dream, it's always, as you said, a retrospective narrative, because during this experience of pure sensation, all these sensations are unbearable in some ways, and so you cannot be like a spectator of like living this sensation and being a spectator. So as the dream works, dreams are always narrative, retrospective narrative, because you always talk about the dream you had last night, and you cannot tell about your dream in your dream to someone else, for example. I don't know if I'm clear, but I would like to explore this notion of this parallel between dream and some sensation.
Yeah.
Yeah,
thanks very much. Very interesting. Merleau-Ponty is very interested in this idea of depersonalization as a structure of perception. And, you know, we usually think about depersonalization as a sort of psychopathological disorder in which one sort of divested of a sense of self and experiences the world in this kind of anodyne, grey, sterile way. Merleau-Ponty, in this quote here and in other quotes, seems to be suggesting that it's not like a deviation from sort of everyday perception, but it's something that underpins everyday perception. And he talks about that in relationship to dream in it, but also the other. And as you say, just on the topic of dreaming, what is peculiar about dreaming is that usually, or all the time, there is the retention of the eye. It's always a first-person perspective. It's usually a modality, a version, a variation of myself as the dreamer. The one way in which that is contested, and another way in which this theme of depersonalization comes to the foreground, I think in a slightly more disruptive sense, because of course in dreaming, once the dream is over, as you also say, you know, very often, of course, we forget it, and then there's a sort of rather rapid reintegration of our normative, habitual orientation in the world, and that kind of depersonalized glimmer, you know, of a world kind of somewhat outside of ourselves is repersonalized, let's say. It's repersonalized. But hypnagogia, this experience of being on the threshold of sleep, but not quite on sleep, is another kind of limit experience where depersonalization comes to the foreground. But what is interesting is that the I, the centrality of the I in which one finds in dreaming, is suspended. And instead, in place of the I, there's a more of a kind of free form, free association of images and whatever sensations and perceptions that seem to come from nowhere and seem to sort of, exact themselves upon this, what is now a kind of depersonalized subject, without any volitional desire. And Merleau-Ponty talks about that, and Sartre also talks about that, and there is a sort of subcurrent within early phenomenologists who were very interested in hypnagogia as another way of trying to think about the limits of perception and the limits of subjective life.
Encore une question.
I just wanted to go back to the flesh part and talking about representation and in cinematographic images. What role do you think the gore jar plays into depersonalize the body and completely go back to the flesh state and taking back, taking away the horror part of it to just go back to pure flesh and blood?
Did you say gore?
Gore, yes.
Yeah. I mean, in the kind of like splatter tradition of late 70s horror, and then of course you have this kind of this renewal in sort of so-called torture porn of this kind of hyper amplification of the goriness of the body and this kind of visceral materiality. I mean, that alone I think for me that can sort of easily veer a bit too closely into this sort of kind of glorification of like special effects and glorification of sort of hyper materiality and hyper violence and things like this. I mean, this is why I always have to come back to Cronenberg, because I think he's just such a master of like introducing those elements that give like real specificity to body parts. You know, I don't know if you like The Fly, for example, if you've seen this film, but okay. You know, in that film, the viewer witnesses like a very, very slow fragmentation of the main subject. Teeth, you know, he's changing into a fly. So the sort of teeth come out, his ears pop out, and it sort of collects, he collects all of these artifacts in his bathroom as a sort of domestic natural history museum. So in those kind of, you know, when it's sort of placed within that context, it has a kind of conceptual richness and a sort of dramatic richness. But on its own, yeah, I mean, I think for me it's too kind of abstract. It needs to be contextualized. I don't know if that was, is that what you were referring to when you talk about gorgeous, like the sheer materiality?
Yeah.
As I said, for me it veers quite, on its own, it's either too abstract or veers too close to a kind of comical articulation body. No, there's nothing wrong with that, of course. It's very much to be welcomed, but somehow it just doesn't have that kind of same level of richness that you might find elsewhere. And then it was John Carpenter, so he's a master of that sort of stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.